This is a brief summary of my third session on Good Friday. We begin with the 4th century diary of Egeria that I gave out as a handout at the end of my previous session. And I am asking the audience to tell me what they find significant about it. The first thing we notice is that the morning of Good Friday is taken up with the display of a piece of the true cross. The wood of the cross had been discovered by the middle of the 4th century and various pieces sent to different places, but a large piece was kept in Jerusalem and brought out on this one occasion so that the faithful could come and worship before it. It's not part of a service, it's simply a mourning of the exposition of this portion of the cross. And our pilgrim Egeria, in describing this, tells us of an occasion she'd heard about when somebody tried to bite a piece off the cross when they knelt to worship it. And so two deacons hold onto it very firmly to try to stop this ever happening again. This is perhaps the most memorable bit in Egeria's diary. Anyone who has ever read it usually recalls this particular passage. And so she tells us that the faithful come in one by one and worship before the cross and then go on out. But as I say, it's not part of an actual service. It's simply a display not only of the cross, but apparently of the inscription that was on the cross, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, and other treasures that the Jerusalem church has, the Solomon's horn of anointing and so on. The main service of the day takes place in the afternoon between 12 and 3, and it's a vigil service of readings and prayers, all on the theme of the crucifixion. Passages from the Old Testament, particularly the Psalms, passages from the New Testament, both the Epistles and the Gospels are read. And this constitutes the whole liturgy, the major liturgy of the day. There is no Eucharist and no reception of communion, but simply this service of the Word that follows the veneration of the cross in the morning. When we turn our attention outside Jerusalem to other places, we see that particularly in early Rome, the days leading up to the Triduum had all been marked by the readings of the gospel readings on the days on which there were public services. So in preparation for Easter, the previous Sunday, the Gospel of St. Matthew's Passion was read. On the Wednesday of the week, which is the next day on which there was a public service, the reading of St. Luke's Passion. And then on Friday, which again was another regular day of a public service, there was the reading of St. John's Gospel. So three of the Gospels were read, the Passionatis of three of the Gospels were read, in preparation for the service on the night of Saturday to Sunday, marking Easter. You'll notice that Mark's Gospel wasn't read. That was because it was at the time thought to be an abbreviation of Matthew's, and so and is shorter than the others. It was omitted, and just the other three were read. So there was a passion theme to the public services that preceded, but as yet nothing special about Good Friday other than the gospel reading of St. John's Passion. And again, there was no Eucharist that day. It was a fast day, and the service would just have consisted of the liturgy of the Word followed by what come to be called the solemn prayers. But these were usually just the usual form of intercession of the Roman Church. That is a series of biddings, asking people to pray for different things, a period of silent prayer, and then a collect after the silent prayer, and then on to the next bidding, another period of silent prayer, another collect on the theme of that. And when we turn to our own prayer book liturgy, we see exactly the same structure is at the core of the service. This stark, solemn liturgy of the word, with the Passion reading from St. John, and then these solemn prayers. They are unusual because our intercessions don't normally take that form, but we believe that the form was standard at Rome. It wasn't a peculiarity of Good Friday. It was true of every public service, but in the course of history, the intercessions got dropped from all the other services in the year in order to shorten the service. Because they were not fixed, they varied depending on what was to be prayed for. They weren't written down, they weren't a fixed part of the liturgy, so they disappeared. But they only remain on Good Friday and therefore seem to us like a peculiarity of Good Friday. One of the prayers in particular has caused concern to more modern people. So although the basic structure of the Roman prayers has been kept, the wording has been changed, and in this prayer in particular, it's the one that prays for unbelievers. Or in its original form, it was particularly directed against the Jews and prayed for their conversion from their hardness of heart. In the 1662 prayer book, it became a prayer for Turks, infidels and heretics, but there's been great concern that this prayer seemed anti-Semitic to modern voices, and so in the Roman Rite prays for God's ancient people, the Jews, and in our own prayer book it has become a more general prayer to avoid the sense that it is anti-Semitic. Another element that was traditionally often included in the service was the reproaches. Oh my people, what have I done? What have you done to me? What have I done to you? You have, I have fed you and you have badly treated me, and so on. And again, this is often interpreted as being anti-Semitic, even though Christians have said it's about humanity's treatment of God, not the Jews' treatment of Christ in particular, that humanity has failed to respond appropriately to God. But many churches now don't use that, and it's not a formal part of our prayer book liturgy requirement. Two other elements come later to be part of the Good Friday liturgy at Rome, and which are also occur as options in our own rite. Many centuries after our pilgrim had been to Jerusalem, we find other churches, particularly those that had acquired pieces of the true cross, producing them on Good Friday as well. But Rome didn't have that, and so for many centuries the service was simply liturgy of the word and prayers. But eventually, a similar ceremony of venerating the cross was appended to the end of the service. Without a relic of the true cross, they simply brought in a large cross in procession and set it up and invited people to come and worship at the crucifix, this large crucifix at the front of the church, if they wished. And that option remains, and many Episcopal churches have adopted that. Though this is an area where Anglicans are not wholly agreed, and so it's not a formal part of the service. Some more evangelical Anglicans feel that it's worshipping an object rather than God. Others would say, no, we are paying homage to Christ, we are honouring Christ, we are expressing our devotion to Christ through our kneeling at the foot of the cross or kissing the cross or whatever form of devotion we want to express, but it's not idolatry. And so, as I say, views vary, and it's never been something that all Anglicans or Episcopalians have done. But it has been an option in many places, and of course where it does happen, not everyone is required to come forward to the cross. Those in the congregation who wish to may come. Some may simply want to kneel and pray near the cross. Others may want to touch it, kiss it, and others may simply want to remain prayerfully in their places. I've stressed all along that there was only ever one Eucharist of Easter, that on Easter Day, there were never a full Eucharist on a day of fasting. Nevertheless, people in many Christian centres wanted to receive communion on that day. The Eastern Church has solved this problem by what they call the Liturgy of the Pre-Sanctified. That is, by bringing in bread and sometimes wine consecrated at a previous Eucharist, so that the people can receive communion on that day, but nevertheless the rule can be kept that there is no Eucharist, so sort of having your cake and eating it. This custom never spread to Western Christianity, the Christianity in Western Europe, but is still practiced regularly on fast days in Lent, in the Eastern churches. But this one day in the year, it eventually did spread to Rome, and so communion from the reserved sacrament takes place in the Roman liturgy after the veneration of the cross, at the conclusion of the service. This, like the veneration of the cross, is another thing on which Anglicans are divided. By and large, Anglicans have not adopted a full Eucharist on Good Friday, so they have kept a tradition. And some have introduced communion, and at Church of the Transfiguration, one of our services has communion and another doesn't on Good Friday. Some Anglicans wish to receive communion that day because it's impossible for them to imagine such a solemn occasion when they don't enter into communion with their Lord. Others retain the view that there is one Eucharist for the Triduum and therefore one occasion to receive communion, and that's at Easter itself, and that Good Friday is not a day for that. So again, we have diverse spiritualities covering those, and the prayer book itself only makes it an option again because of this.